Hi, this is Michael Roy, Executive Editor of the American Journal of Psychiatry. We're conducting a brief survey about this podcast, and we'd really appreciate hearing from you. To complete the survey, please go to ajp.psychiatryonline.org/audio and select the link at that page. Your answers will remain anonymous, and we thank you for your feedback. That's ajp.psychiatryonline.org/audio, and you'll see the survey link there. Again, you can complete the survey anonymously, and it won't take more than a few minutes. Now, on to this month's episode.
Welcome to the Audio Digest of the American Journal of Psychiatry. This is Dr. Susan Schultz with highlights for September 2017. Our clinical topics include the challenges of treating undocumented immigrants. We also have two articles on medication. One reviews the long-term effects of antipsychotics in schizophrenia. The other looks at whether substance use problems are linked to medications for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Another study examined whether coordinated specialty care for first episode psychosis affects use of Social Security disability benefits. We'll also present a large genome-wide association study of anorexia nervosa. And we'll report findings on when medical students decide to become psychiatrists and what factors influence their decision. This article has been selected as meriting CME for readers who subscribe to the AJP CME course program. Each month, brief companion exams are created for three articles from the issue. By reading the articles and completing the online exam, individuals can earn up to one AMA PRA Category 1 credit per article. This activity is sponsored by the American Psychiatric Association. To subscribe, click on the CME link at the top of our homepage, ajp.psychiatryonline.org. We'll begin the highlights with our Treatment in Psychiatry article about treating undocumented immigrants. Neil Krishnan Agarwal reviews the availability and utilization of mental health services for undocumented immigrants in the U.S. He also presents a case complicated by countertransference. Unauthorized immigrants can't be covered for routine health visits through federally funded programs. However, they can receive emergency medical services without restriction, and they can apply for emergency Medicaid if they qualify for low-income status. In addition, states can use non-federal funds to provide care at community health centers and safety net hospitals. Unauthorized immigrants have higher rates of anxiety, depression, and post-traumatic stress disorder compared with authorized immigrants and citizens. However, most of them are uninsured, so they opt for safety net care. And there are other barriers to treatment. Many unauthorized immigrants are afraid of being reported to the authorities, can't communicate well, or are unfamiliar with the healthcare system. There can also be barriers at the clinician level. Culture and ethnicity can trigger powerful transference and countertransference reactions, such as hostility or ambivalence. Clinicians may also face language barriers or cultural misunderstandings. The cultural formulation interview in DSM-5 can help clinicians ask patients about their identities, relationships, and conceptions of illness and treatment. A supplementary module encourages clinicians to consider how these patient factors affect diagnostic assessment and treatment planning. Culture is defined as systems of knowledge and practices that are learned and transmitted. Next is a review article about the long-term effects of antipsychotic medication. There have been concerns because antipsychotic treatment is linked to brain volume reduction and dopamine receptor sensitization. Donald Goff and colleagues convened an international panel of experts in antipsychotic pharmacology, neuroimaging, and neuropathology. They reviewed the literature on potential adverse effects of antipsychotics on long-term outcomes. Little evidence was found to support a negative long-term effect. Randomized controlled trials strongly support the efficacy of antipsychotics for the acute treatment of psychosis and for the prevention of relapse. Correlational evidence indicates that early intervention and reduced duration of untreated psychosis might improve longer-term outcomes. In naturalistic studies, a small number of patients recovered from a first episode of psychosis without pharmacologic treatment, or they discontinued medication and remained stable for extended periods. However, there are no clinical measures or biomarkers to identify these patients prospectively. Evidence from preclinical animal models is mixed regarding whether antipsychotics have neuroprotective effects. And it's not possible to conclude from the available imaging studies whether brain volume loss during the course of illness is attributable to antipsychotics or to the underlying disorder. Patients and families should be informed about the strong evidence for antipsychotic efficacy. They should also be told about the side effects, which vary between drugs. Now we'll highlight a landmark study on the genetics of anorexia nervosa. Twin studies support a genetic basis for familial aggregation. However, genome-wide association studies are needed. The initial ones were underpowered, so Laramie Duncan and colleagues combined existing samples. The total group included more than 3,000 cases of anorexia nervosa. They indicated that a substantial fraction of the twin-based heritability of anorexia nervosa arises from common genetic variation. They also demonstrated what appears to be the first genome-wide significant association for anorexia nervosa. The significant locus is on chromosome 12. It's a broad region that covers multiple genes. It includes a previously reported locus for type 1 diabetes and autoimmune disorders. Also, significant positive genetic correlations were observed between anorexia nervosa and several psychiatric phenotypes, including schizophrenia, neuroticism, and obsessive-compulsive disorder. Genetic correlations were also found with several metabolic variables. Anorexia nervosa was positively correlated with high-density lipoprotein cholesterol and negatively correlated with body mass index, insulin, glucose, and lipid phenotypes. These results encourage reconceptualization of anorexia nervosa as having a combined psychiatric and metabolic etiology. Now we'll look at psychiatry as a career choice. Health policy makers, as well as psychiatric educators, are interested in recruiting medical students into psychiatry. Developing strategies depends on understanding how medical students choose to specialize in psychiatry. To identify relevant factors, Matthew Goldenberg and colleagues examined answers to surveys conducted by the American Association of Medical Colleges. The surveys were completed by medical students at the beginning and the end of medical school. Data were collected for nearly 30,000 students who graduated in 2013 and 2014. By far the factor most predictive of the choice of psychiatry at graduation was an interest in psychiatry at the beginning of medical school. The proportion of students entering medical school who had already chosen a specialty was higher for psychiatry than for any other specialty. Still, of the students who choose psychiatry at graduation, almost 80% didn't indicate this preference at matriculation. For this group, the factors most strongly related to the choice of psychiatry were having an excellent psychiatry clerkship, majoring in psychology as an undergraduate, and valuing work-life balance. Students who reported excellent teaching from psychiatric residents also had higher odds of choosing psychiatry. Other characteristics related to the choice of psychiatry were older age, undergraduate psychology and English literature classes taken for personal interest, and a Bachelor of Arts degree rather than a Bachelor of Science. Now we'll turn to attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD. There's concern that patients with ADHD who take stimulants might have an increased risk for substance-related problems. Conclusions from randomized clinical trials have been constrained by sample sizes. Also, the treatment durations may have been too short to permit generalization or to detect rare but serious substance-related events. Patrick Quinn and colleagues did a large-scale observational study in which patients basically acted as their own control subjects. Substance-related events during periods when they were taking ADHD medication were compared with events during periods when they weren't taking medication. The data were from commercial insurance claims. Records were analyzed over 9 years. ADHD patients were defined as enrollees who received either an ADHD diagnosis or a prescription for atomoxetine or a stimulant used to treat ADHD. Patients were followed from the date of the first inpatient or outpatient diagnosis or the date of the first filled prescription until the end of the study. Only periods in which patients were at least 13 years old were included. Substance-related events were defined as emergency department visits related to substance use disorders. Compared to periods in which the patients did not receive ADHD medication, both male and female patients had about a third lower odds of concurrent substance-related events when receiving medication. In addition, male patients had lower odds of substance-related events 2 years after the medication periods. The findings for long-term effects for women were less consistent. Next, we'll look at financial help for people with first-episode psychosis. Social Security Administration disability benefits are an important source of income for people with psychosis. They also confer eligibility for health insurance. Robert Rosenheck and colleagues examined whether a coordinated specialty care program would affect whether patients with first episode psychosis received disability benefits. Data were collected as part of the RAISE-ETP study, Recovery After an Initial Schizophrenia Episode Early Treatment Program. The study included a trial of a program combining personalized medication management, family psychoeducation, individual resilience-focused training, and supported employment. The program was called Navigate, and it was compared with usual community care. Both were provided in community mental health centers. The study lasted 2 years. Receipt of either Social Security disability insurance or supplemental security income was recorded over the course of treatment. Among the individuals who weren't receiving either type of Social Security disability benefit at the beginning of the study, about a third obtained benefits during the 2-year study period. The Navigate intervention improved quality of life, symptoms, and employment more than usual care. However, it didn't reduce the likelihood of receiving Social Security disability benefits. Obtaining benefits was predicted by more severe psychotic symptoms and greater dysfunction. New beneficiaries also had worse employment histories and less education. Obtaining benefits was followed by fewer days of employment, reduced sense of purpose, and greater anhedonia. On the other hand, it was also related to fewer days of intoxication. This concludes our audio highlights of the September issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. Please visit our website, ajp.psychiatryonline.org, for the complete versions of these and other articles. We also welcome comments. They can be emailed to ajp@psychpsych.org. Next month, our topics will include misleading guidance from pharmacogenetic testing, the efficacy of psychodynamic therapy relative to other treatments, the protective effect of pregnancy on risk for drug abuse, the relation of ovarian steroid levels to premenstrual dysphoric symptoms, and rates of mortality and self-harm for clozapine and other antipsychotics. We hope you'll join us. Thank you for listening.